PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Today, a discussion about free speech in wartime. We'll take a look at the history of the American debate on civil liberties and national security. Our guest is University of Chicago Law Professor Jeffrey Stone. He is the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. In this book, Professor Stone explores six episodes in our history when the government moved to punish individuals for speaking out against government policies or officials. He says while the government regulates speech in many ways, it has punished dissent only in wartime. Today we'll talk about those perilous times when the government acted to restrict political speech. We'll talk about the people who were affected and how they were affected. We'll talk about those who struggled in good faith to balance liberty and security, and those who exploited fear. I suspect we'll also talk about current civil liberties issues. Listeners, I welcome your participation in our discussion this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, if it would be long distance for you, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Jeffrey Stone was dean of the law school at the University of Chicago from 1987 to 1994. He served as provost of the university from 1992 to 2002. He recently represented Fred Korematsu in a friend of the court brief in the U.S. Supreme Court in the Guantanamo Bay case. His book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, is published by Norton. Jeffrey Stone joins us this afternoon from the University of Chicago. Professor Stone, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Why do you suppose that through our history, the threats against speech have been limited to perilous times?
There is a natural tension between dissent and the perception of disloyalty that raises the stakes dramatically, both emotionally and in real effect. An individual who criticizes a war, the ways in which the national leaders are prosecuting the war, whether the war itself is moral or just or futile, is performing an important service in a self-governing society, because in a democracy it's essential that citizens deliberate about those questions while a war is going on, and those issues cannot be put into suspension. On the other hand, and at the same time, sharp criticism of the way in which the United States is prosecuting a war or questions about whether the war is just or should continue have the effect of strengthening the resolve of the enemy. An enemy who knows that the United States is uncertain or divided about a war knows that if it can continue its own efforts in the combat, that it may be able to achieve a victory or a more favorable settlement of the conflict, not necessarily on the battlefield, but through the domestic political debate within the United States. And therefore, those who are committed to the war, those who are convinced that the war is just and wise and necessary, are understandably upset by those who would criticize the war because they deem that criticism essentially an act that makes it more difficult for the United States to prosecute the war successfully, which could mean more deaths of American soldiers. And so wartime does create this inherent conflict, which naturally leads itself to the incentive to suppress dissent.
If a government is moved to suppress dissent in perilous times, does the fallout from that continue after the threat or perceived threat has passed?
One of the common perceptions that civil libertarians tend to put forth, and I count myself as a civil libertarian, is that once civil liberties are sacrificed, that they cannot be regained. And yet, in fact, our own history belies that. The truth is that in each of these historical episodes where we have significantly overreacted to the real dangers presented by speech and unduly restricted either freedom of expression in particular or civil liberties in general, the effort to repress those liberties ended with the end of the conflict. And afterwards, the United States returned to a period of at least equal respect for freedom of speech and civil liberties, and oftentimes with even a better understanding of those rights. So the fact is that there is not this trajectory in which rights lost remain lost forever. There's rather a cyclical effect in which in periods of great crisis or stress, there's a temptation to overreact. But then once those crises end, there is a pattern of returning back to a period of normalcy.
In this book, Perilous Times, you identify and examine six periods of our history when people were punished for criticizing the government. Would you give us a brief outline of them?
Sure. The first was in 1798, less than a decade after we adopted the Constitution and when the nation was very young. And at this point in time, there was a bitter conflict within the United States between the Federalist Party, led by John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, and the Republican Party, led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And at this time, there was a fear that the United States might enter into a war with France, which was then the world's greatest military power. And the Federalists, using the fear of a possible conflict with France as a justification, enacted the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, which were one of the most repressive types of legislation in American history. In the Civil War, the United States obviously faced one of its greatest challenges. Abraham Lincoln, as president, suspended the writ of habeas corpus on eight separate occasions, and we can go back later if you like and talk about what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that happened during the Civil War was that even within the Union itself, there was both extraordinarily vituperative criticism of Lincoln and of his administration, and through the suspensions of habeas corpus, sometimes quite dramatic repression of free expression. During World War I, the United States suffered arguably the most repressive and most dangerous period in American history with respect to freedom of speech, wherein the Wilson administration prohibited essentially any criticism of the war or the draft or of the Wilson administration in any way relating to its conduct of the war. During World War II, there was relatively little dissent in the United States against the war because we were directly attacked in World War II, and therefore most American citizens understood that we didn't have any choice but to fight the war. Nonetheless, there were individuals who were prosecuted by the Roosevelt administration because of their fascist beliefs or tendencies. And of course, in World War II, the most dramatic civil liberties issues involved the internment of 120,000 individuals of Japanese descent, which is not a speech issue as such, but which obviously raised profound questions about civil liberties. The fifth period was in the Cold War, during the period of McCarthyism, in which government at all levels and the private sector essentially targeted individuals because of past or present beliefs and associations, in particular individuals who were thought in some way to have had affiliations with the Communist Party or the Communist movement. And that period, which we now think of as a time of McCarthyism and witch hunts, was again one of great repression. And then most recently, putting aside the present situation, was the Vietnam War. During Vietnam, interestingly and importantly, it was clear that by 1968, the government of the United States could no longer, either constitutionally or in terms of public culture, criminally prosecute someone like Eugene McCarthy for publicly criticizing the war and the draft, even though in most of the prior episodes I mentioned, individuals analogous to McCarthy were routinely criminally punished. But nonetheless, the government used a wide variety of mechanisms, mostly through the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to expose, disrupt, neutralize, harass, and silence critics of the war. So in each of these episodes, for various reasons and in differing degrees, we see instances in which the government felt both the necessity and the opportunity to suppress dissent, partly because of a felt necessity in order to rally the nation and remain unified, partly as a way of acceding to the fears and anxieties of the public, and partly as a way of exploiting the situation for partisan political gain.
Hmm. World War One. Now, correct me if I'm misremembering what you just said, but didn't you just call it the period of greatest repression of speech rights?
Yes. When the United States entered the First World War, there was a great deal of division about the wisdom of that decision. We have to remember that in 1916, the year before, Wilson was reelected on the platform that he kept us out of war. Most Americans viewed the carnage in Europe as a matter that did not affect any vital American interests. For the most part, the view of most Americans was to stand on the sidelines and let the British, French, Germans, and others essentially destroy each other, but not to get involved ourselves. Nonetheless, in the years leading up to 1917, the United States increasingly came involved in the matter because of freedom of the seas. Essentially, the United States took the position correctly under international law that as a neutral, we were entitled under international law to trade freely with all of the belligerents. The belligerents, of course, did not much like the idea of the United States trading with their enemies. The British and French were able to pretty much prevent the United States from shipping armaments and munitions and supplies to Germany because Germany has relatively limited access to the sea and it was easy to mine the various rivers and harbors that could have been used to trade with Germany. Germany, on the other hand, had a more difficult quandary, because England and France, of course, have much greater access to the sea, and Germany had to resort to submarine warfare. In that submarine warfare, the Germans sunk many American ships that were delivering supplies, including armaments and munitions, to the Allies. Wilson eventually, after having several warnings of the Germans, in which the Germans' response was, don't ship to them, and we'll leave you alone, sought a declaration of war. Now, many Americans saw this as not a war to make the world safe for democracy, as Wilson had billed it, but really a war to make the world safe for armaments manufacturers and munitions shippers. Their view was, if staying out of the war means that we should simply forego trading with England and France during the conflict, then that's a better alternative than sending hundreds of thousands or millions of American soldiers to fight on the battlefields of Europe. So there was a great division about whether to go into the war, even at the time that the declaration of war was sought. Moreover, in order to staff the army, Wilson had to reinstitute the draft for the first time since the Civil War, which was also highly unpopular. So Wilson then basically had a serious problem facing him in terms of getting the nation itself and the citizenry to be enthusiastic and unified in its support of the war. And to do that, he essentially took a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, in order to develop a sense of passion for the war, he created the Committee on Public Information, which was a propaganda arm of the federal government, whose charge was to produce a flood of pamphlets, leaflets, lectures, movies, and the like, all of which were designed to promote a hatred of all things German and a distrust of anyone who might be unenthusiastic about the United States' participation in the war. And then the other problem Wilson had was there were many dissidents. There were many people who were openly criticizing the war. And in order to eliminate that, Wilson got through Congress first the Espionage Act of 1917 and then the Sedition Act of 1918. And the practical effect of those two laws was to make it a criminal offense for any person to criticize the administration, the war, the draft, the Constitution, the uniform, or the flag of the United States. And these laws were aggressively pursued by federal prosecutors. More than 2,000 individuals were prosecuted under these laws, ranging on the one hand from the obscure, like 20-year-old Molly Steimer, a Russian Jewish emigre, who was prosecuted and convicted for throwing a bunch of leaflets in Yiddish from a rooftop on the Lower East Side of New York. She was sentenced to 15 years in prison and then deported. To the other extreme of Eugene Debs, who was the national leader of the Socialist Party, who'd received 1 million votes for president in 1912, which was 6% of all votes cast, who was prosecuted under the Espionage Act for giving a speech in Ohio in which he, by innuendo, criticized the Wilson administration's use of the draft and its suppression of free speech. And Debs was sentenced to a prison term of 10 years. So the net effort of the administration during World War I was essentially and indeed effectively to wipe out any criticism of the government during that conflict.
Hmm. We have here a number of periods of time, a number of times when the U.S. clearly just went overboard, went too far in sacrificing civil liberties. Have we learned from the past? We keep running into these periods of time where we run in again and again to this inherent conflict. But have we learned from the past in terms of how we deal with that conflict?
We've learned in fits and starts. The problem is that the emotions and the passions and the fears and the anger created by a wartime environment lend themselves very readily to an immediately repressive response. And to resist that requires a great deal of fortitude on the part of the public and national leaders. And it's not always the case that we are able or willing to demonstrate a kind of principled self-restraint. So I would say that we have, as a society, learned some important lessons. The most dramatic illustration of that, I think, is that in 1798, during the period of the Sedition Act, it was not uncommon for federal congressmen to be prosecuted and convicted under the Sedition Act of 1798 for criticizing the Adams administration. During the Civil War, Clement Vallandigham, who was one of the leaders of the National Peace Democrat Party, the party that basically believed that the Union should let the South go rather than fight a war that would ultimately cost 600,000 lives, was arrested and prosecuted by military authorities and ordered to be imprisoned for the remainder of the Civil War, eventually exiled instead by Lincoln. And of course, as I said already, during World War I, we saw that Eugene Debs was sentenced to prison for 10 years. So a key thing that we have learned, which I think we can look at and take comfort in and feel good about, is that the idea today of prosecuting Howard Dean or John Kerry because of their criticism of the war in Iraq, which was no different than the criticism of Eugene Debs in 1917 or Clement Vallandigham in 1863 or Matthew Lyon in 1798, is really an amazing achievement. We take it for granted now. We tend to think that, of course, why would we ever even imagine that it was appropriate to prosecute someone like Howard Dean or John Kerry? But through most of our history, they would have gone to jail for saying what they did at a time that they said it. And that's a clear example of progress. On the other hand, that progress is fragile. Because the passions of wartime are so great, good judgment can easily be swamped. So imagine if we had had not one 9/11 attack, but we had had four or six 9/11 attacks within a relatively short period of time. There's no telling what pressures might then have existed for the government to do all sorts of things that would, again, with the benefit of hindsight, perhaps have looked as just as extreme as Wilson's efforts during World War I or some of Lincoln's steps during the Civil War.
Yeah. Well, while we've seen progress, we remain faced with challenges and dangers, and the progress, as you noted, can be fragile. And while the perilous times we've seen in our past have been unique, there are some common themes here. One is that you identify early in the book, Perilous Times, the status of aliens. Another, you mentioned Clement Vallandigham. He was a civilian, but brought before a military commission. There are some things that kind of are, you know, ringing the doorbell, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's like there are similarities through each period of time, even though they were very, very unique periods of time.
Yeah, it's very common in wartime. And again, understandable, but unfortunate, for the majority of citizens and the government to look for, one might call them scapegoats, one might call them simply proxies for the real enemy, but to look for an other. The Alien Act of 1798 was directed, by definition, specifically at aliens, and it gave the President of the United States, John Adams, the authority to detain and to deport any non-citizen who Adams found to be potentially a danger to the United States. The Republicans, Jefferson and Madison, furiously protested this legislation as a blatant violation of the Constitution. The Federalists of Adams' party resisted with the notion that aliens have no rights under the United States Constitution, that they are simply not part of we the people. During the Civil War, the issue was not one about aliens. It was one about secessionist sympathizers in the North. And individuals who were identified as potential sympathizers with the South were tarred and ostracized and prosecuted in much the same way as aliens in the earlier era. During World War I, there was a conflation of hostility to aliens, particularly individuals of German descent, and also German Americans, as well as socialists, anarchists, pacifists, internationalists, all of those others who were seen as different from the mainstream American and who opposed the war. And during World War II, of course, the issue concerned Japanese citizens, and it's important to keep in mind, Japanese Americans. Two-thirds of the 120,000 mm-hmm. individuals who were interned in World War II were citizens of the United States of Japanese descent. They were not Japanese citizens. And now, of course, in the war on terrorism, the government has focused a great deal of its attention, certainly in the months after 9/11, on non-citizens, including rounding up and detaining 1,000 or so of those individuals, holding them essentially incommunicado, not identifying them for the media or for even their family members to know what happened to them, and then holding an unprecedented closed deportation proceeding in order to make determinations as to whether these individuals should be deported without allowing the American public to have any idea of what the rationale was for those deportations or what the evidence was on which they were based. So there is this common theme, as you point out, of the majority and the government looking for an enemy within. And sometimes that is associated with aliens, particularly when we're dealing with a war where the role of aliens and the possible subversion, espionage, sabotage that could be connected with aliens exists. Other times it's simply individuals within the United States who can be seen as subversive or disloyal. During the Vietnam War, it would be hippies. There would be no connection to any particular group of foreigners, but it would be a sort of social, cultural distinction that was drawn.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, University of Chicago Law Professor Jeffrey Stone. He is the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the war on terrorism. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have a couple of listeners ready to talk with us this afternoon. First, we go to Indiana, caller on line 4. Good afternoon.
Three things, I guess. First two are just sort of like comments. One is I'm retired now, and I went through high school in the 50s and college and graduate school in the 60s. And it just amazes me the feelings I had when I was a young kid reading the history of America, and now what the feelings I have when I look at, you know, the underside of America. I've always thought it, you know, really bad that we don't, you know, since bring these bad periods up to let the youth know that we've been here before, and this is what happens when these things happen. Most of the people now don't have any bearing on, you know, if you bring up something from 1798, you're just whistling in the wind. And even as far back, you know, just as close as World War One, and I guess the Vietnam War, I was photographed a lot. I used to smile at them and wave a hand and stuff. And I never could understand why in hell they thought I was dangerous. But anyway, they did that. And the next one is just recently this Muslim scholar from Switzerland can't get into the country to teach at one of the better universities in the country, in Notre Dame. I still haven't found out why he's so dangerous. And I guess the third question I'd bring up, if you want to, what else is on the Bush administration's agenda to... curtail civil liberties, or in the broad sense, or even a more micro environment, if you had any information on that. Thanks a lot.
Sure. With respect to the first point, I could not agree more. I think that we do tend to teach a celebratory version of our national history, and there's a lot to celebrate. I mean, the truth is the United States is a remarkable nation. But the fact also is if we want citizens to be thoughtful and reflective and responsible, then they also have to understand the dangers of democracy. And if they don't understand those dangers, then there's a risk that we will continue to repeat the mistakes of the past. So I think that point is exactly right, and it's an incredibly important aspect of how we as a nation can be better. The single most important safeguard against making the same mistakes again is not ultimately our elected officials or our courts. It's the American people themselves. They have to be aware of the dangers of becoming hysterical and falling into a kind of war fever. And they, even more important, have to understand the dangers of being manipulated by political figures who have historically taken advantage of these situations in order to engage in a partisan opportunism. With respect to the second point, the exclusion from the United States of the Muslim scholar, I find that also deeply troubling. The United States, under law, is authorized to make decisions about immigration in ways that are much broader and more discretionary than in the ways in which it can deal with individuals, whether citizens or non-citizens, once they are in the United States. So under the law, as it has been enacted and construed up until this point, it may not be unconstitutional for the federal government to exclude a scholar because someone in the government believes that the individual is in some way dangerous. But that doesn't mean that it's good policy. It doesn't mean that it's right. I don't know whether there is some basis for this decision, but everything I have read about it certainly suggests that there is not, and I think that is deeply troubling. We should not be preventing individuals from entering the United States who have something to say because we don't want to hear it. And the third point, I forget, was...
On the agenda. What's on the agenda?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, it's hard to know that. I mean, one of the fundamental facts about the present situation is that because we have not had additional terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11, there is both much less of a sense on the part of the American people of immediate anxiety about that issue. And therefore, it is much more difficult for the administration to justify doing anything that might be seen to be draconian. And in the years since 9/11, we have seen several instances in which the administration has floated proposals of programs that were potentially very restrictive on free speech or other liberties that have been shelved because of a negative public reaction. So, for example, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, at one point proposed a TIPS program, which was essentially a program designed to encourage individuals to report to the Department of Justice anyone who they thought might be suspicious or potentially dangerous. This was opposed by a great many people, including some Republican legislators, as a very dangerous way to encourage citizens to behave, and that was put on a back burner. There was also the Total Information Awareness Program that the administration proposed that would have been under the direction of Poindexter that was designed to be a massive data collection program in order for the government to have information about as many citizens as possible, including their telephone calls and their credit cards and everything else that they do in their routine daily life. And again, there was great opposition to this, and it was put on the back burner. And third, of course, the administration floated Patriot Act II, which was a much more aggressive and ambitious effort to empower the executive branch to engage in a wide range of activities that currently are not authorized. And again, this was met with opposition and was shelved. So we've seen some instances of what people within the administration have been thinking about, but it's clear that in the present political environment, they would not be able to put those in place. Obviously, we all hope that there's not another attack, and therefore there won't be an opportunity for the administration to push those forward. But I do think it's important to recognize that should there be another attack or a surge of attacks, that there will almost immediately thereafter be a wide range of proposals by the administration, most of which the United States citizens and government have rightly decided are unwise, that will look much more appealing in the emotional afterglow of another attack. And that's exactly how we tend to get in trouble in these circumstances.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Your last set of points really hits right to the idea that I wanted to ask you about. Part of your thesis seems to be that we require cycles for this for people to have more freedom at some times and more repression at other times. It's the crisis that precipitates more repression. When the crisis goes away, then you get more freedom. But everybody, all the major players in the Bush administration, including the president himself, the vice president, Powell, Rumsfeld, Rice, I mean, everybody has been saying that this is going to be, this war on terror is going to be something that may never end. Colin Powell, I guess, gave the most positive perspectives when he said that it may only take generations to win this war. Bush himself had said that it's not winnable. So given that we're going to be in a permanent state of war, apparently, this is going to last as long as our country does, will we ever see that cycle again? And given that we are in this permanent state of war, won't it just lead to more and more and more repressions or restrictions of freedoms and rights and so on over a longer time frame? So the Bush administration may not be able to make some of these changes, such as Patriot II and some of the other things you had just mentioned, but maybe the next administration or the one after that, maybe each administration is just going to just take a little pickaxe and just take a little chip out of it. And given that we're battling a war that's never going to end, they have the luxury of taking their time. How does that fit into your thesis? What's the perspective there, do you think? And I'll just listen offline. Thanks.
Well, that's very astute. I think that personally, I think the notion that this is an indefinite war without end is a rhetorical device rather than a realistic assessment. The world changes, circumstances change, and I'm very doubtful about this being a war that will be going on, whatever the word war means in this context, 100 years from now. But if one takes seriously the administration's claim that this is going to be, let's say, a very long-term situation, then I think that gives even greater reason to be extremely skeptical about restrictions of civil liberties, because those restrictions will not be short-term and temporary and based only upon an emergency basis. They will become a long-term and permanent fixture of the American political system and democracy, and that would be extraordinarily troubling, because one of the consolations one can take from the history is that these periods have been relatively short-run, and therefore, however damaging the restrictions have been, and in some instances they've been extremely damaging, at least they're time-bound. If one believes that the current situation is, in fact, not time-bound or not reasonably time-bound, then I think that calls for us to be that much more careful about making any of the types of changes that the Bush administration or its successors might want to put into place. The other point I'd like to make about the question, which is I think extremely important, is that when one goes back in these periods and looks at how various administrations dealt with these circumstances, it's clear that it is very important, if we're to deal well with these crises, that there be individuals within the highest councils of government who truly value civil liberties and who are a voice for saying, let's be careful about this. There are many ways to achieve a certain level of security in the nation. Let's not leap to the assumption that the best way to achieve those levels of security is by restricting free speech or by suspending the writ of habeas corpus or by engaging in widespread searches. There are other ways of achieving it. Let's look at those other ways. Those voices, when they exist, can have an important moderating effect. And those administrations that have not had those voices within the higher councils have tended to be the ones that were most extreme. One of the things that should be most unnerving to American citizens about the current administration is not only that there are no voices of moderation or voices of individuals who would champion this perspective, but such voices have been intentionally and clearly excluded from the highest councils of government. And that should be cause for great concern.
Let's talk with another listener. Listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm thinking of two quotations. One, to paraphrase, my country right or wrong, when right to keep it right, when wrong to be put right. And another by Henry Ward Beecher in 1887, the fear of doing right is the grand treason in times of danger. And I think if you put both of those quotes together, it kind of speaks to the importance of dissent, particularly when the country is involved in, you know, putting its children out in harm's way. My question is, as far as I can tell, the founding fathers themselves didn't exactly worry about sedition. And in fact, they were worried about the use of the charge of treason in a political way, using treason as a political tool. So my question to you is, if things really changed that much, that the mere notion of sedition should engender all these laws and all this legal going on. You know, I really doubt this whole thing that we're speaking to, and it was even less so in World War One, but that we're speaking to the enemy somehow and giving them comfort. Any enemy general out there, you know, who would bank on, you know, what he heard being uttered by protesters would be foolish to, you know, rely on that.
Let me add one quote to your two, which are wonderful. Justice Louis Brandeis said that courage is the secret of liberty. And I think that's absolutely true. Having courage and belief in our own system is fundamental to preserving that liberty. In terms of the framers, it's important to know that they were engaged in an experiment. I mean, they had stepped off a cliff. In essentially recorded memory, there had not been a self-governing society of the sort that they were attempting to put in place. And they had no idea what was going to happen. And there was a sharp division, as I said earlier, between the Federalists and the Republicans in their view about what this new country would be. The Federalists were very skeptical about the wisdom of the common man. And they were very much afraid that the ordinary citizen could easily be misled, could be panicked into lawfully or unlawfully engaging in decisions that would be extraordinarily damaging to the stability and security of the nation, and particularly to the security and stability of the Federalists. And the Republicans, who were much more confident about the system, also believed, as Jefferson said, that the United States needs a revolution every 20 years. So they saw themselves very much engaged in an experiment. And one of the things that's, I think, very interesting about our history is that we now, in a sense, take for granted our own confidence in our system. It is something that is hard bought and that has taken us two centuries to achieve. And when one asks, what's that all about? I mean, in Iraq, the United States says it's trying to create a democracy. And we understand that that means not just shipping them voting booths, but that it means developing a culture which includes values like intellectual curiosity, a willingness to question one's leaders, a sense of oneself as a governor, not as a subject, a tolerance for views with which one disagrees. Well, these are all characteristics that did not exist at the framing of the Constitution or in the first 10 or 20 years. And they do exist to a quite surprising and impressive degree today in our country. And what that means in part is that we are capable of dealing with a much greater degree of disagreement and dissent among ourselves than perhaps we were capable of dealing with 100 or 150 years ago. And that's an important part of what we've accomplished as a nation. And it's one of the reasons why the cry of sedition today, as applied to someone like John Kerry or Howard Dean, sounds vaguely or absolutely ludicrous, where it would not have sounded ludicrous at all 80 or 200 years ago.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We only have a couple of minutes left in this portion of the program. And, you know, your book, Professor Stone, is just full of stories about people who struggled with balancing liberty and security, and stories about people who were persecuted and prosecuted for dissent. And I think one of the themes here that we've had in our discussion this afternoon is that there is a lot to celebrate, but yet there is a lot we can do to keep what we have and yet to maybe go beyond to do better. And one of the wonderful characters, I think he's the first character that you introduce us to, is a coarse, bombastic fellow by the name of Matthew Lyon. And you know, in terms of offering listeners a little flesh and blood here at the end of our discussion this afternoon, maybe you would tell us just a little bit about Matthew Lyon.
Sure. One of the things I tried to do in the book is to not write it as the level of abstraction, but to, as you say, make it flesh and blood and bring it down to the real individuals, and often individuals who are not well known to the American public, but who are heroes or villains in these various stories. So Matthew Lyon was an immigrant to the United States coming from Ireland. He wound up in Vermont and was a local entrepreneur. He was a Republican, meaning he supported Jefferson. He believed very much in the common man. He ran three times for Congress unsuccessfully and was finally elected. He got to Congress and As you said, he was coarse and bombastic and kind of a frontiersman type character. And he did not fit in at all with the Federalists, who dominated Congress, who were rather effete. And he insulted them, and both in his manner and in his substance. On one occasion, he spit in the eye of another congressman who had insulted him. The Federalists tried to have him expelled from Congress, but were unable to achieve that, after which the congressman at whom Lyon had spat proceeded to beat him over the head in Congress with a hickory stick. During the Sedition Act, Lyon was the first person prosecuted under the act, which made it a crime for any person to criticize the president, the Congress, or the government of the United States. And he was prosecuted in Vermont, convicted, sentenced to 6 months in prison. He served his term in prison, ran for re-election while in prison, and was victorious, the first person ever to be re-elected to office in the United States while in jail, returned to Washington to serve out his next term, and then decided thereafter that he'd had it with politics and picked up and moved out to the western frontier. He again found himself interested in politics, was reelected, went back to the Congress for a while. Then, after the War of 1812, was finally defeated on the ground that he'd become too conservative and was seen very much like the former Federalist, which is quite ironic. And that led to the end of his political career. He eventually moved out to the Mississippi and ran a trading post in an isolated bluff with Native Americans representing the United States. And just before his death, when the United States had promised to provide a cotton gin and then reneged on the promise, he got on a raft and went 3,000 miles down to New Orleans to get the makings of a cotton gin in the middle of winter, brought it back to provide it for the Native Americans, and then died in this isolated post out on the Mississippi. So one of many quite remarkable characters who play a role in creating our history.
Yeah, what a character, but you know, I like him. Mm-hmm. I like him very much. And the book is peopled with all kinds of interesting folk, villains and heroes. And there we'll have to leave it because we're out of time. Professor Stone, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And also our thanks this afternoon to Elliot Brennan at the University of Chicago for his help there in the studio this afternoon at the University of Chicago. Jeffrey Stone's book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, From the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, is published by Norton. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, this is the way the futures finish the day. December wheat at the board at 287 and a quarter high, low at 284. Settlement price there at 285. They were down a penny and three quarters at the end of this Tuesday afternoon. March futures, 302 the high, the low at 296. Settlement price there at 301, and they were up 2 cents for the day. May contract, 2 and a quarter higher today. 308 and three quarters the high, the low at 303 and a quarter, settled at 308, even for the May wheat. July futures, 315 and a half the high, the low at 309 and three quarters, the harvest month for the wheat, settled 314 and three quarters, up 2 cents in September contract. A 321 and a half high, low at 317, settled 321 and a half up on the high for the September wheat, two higher for the day. From the corn pit now, December contract, a 197 high, low at 194. They finished the day 2 and a quarter lower, but they were the only loser in the corn pit for the day, down 2 and a quarter in the December contract at 195. March corn now, 206 and a quarter the high, the low at 203 and three quarters. Settled 206, a penny and a quarter higher, and the rest of the pit was up a penny and a quarter. So these are the numbers as they came across. May futures, 214 high, low at 211 and a half, settled 13 and three quarters, and they were up 1 and a quarter. Once again, the May at 213 and three quarters. July up a penny and a quarter as well, 221 and a quarter high, Low at 218 and three quarters, settled 221, 1 1/4 higher. September corn, 228 and three quarters high. The low at 26 and three quarters, settled up on that high at 228 and three quarters, a penny and a quarter higher a bushel. December futures for next year, 238 and a quarter the high. The low at 236, settled $2.38 a bushel, up 1 1/4. December oat futures, 175 the high. The low and the settlement price all at $1.75, up 3 cents for the day. And the March oat futures, 157 and a half the high, the low at 153.5, settled 157.5, and they were 2.5 higher. From the soy complex now, January beans, 551 high, low at 542, settled 550 1/4, 3.5 higher in the March contract. A 550.5 high, low at 541, settled $5.50, they were up 4 cents. In the May contract, 554 the high, low at 545.5, settled 553. Up 3 3/4. July futures, 560 the high, the low at 551.5. Settlement at 559.5, and they were up 4 in the August. 560 the high, the low at 555.5. Settled 562, up 3.5 cents. September futures, 562 the high, the low at 557. Settled $5.62, up 2 3/4. And the November beans, 572.5 the high, the low at 564. Settlement price, $5.72. They were up 3.5 cents for the day. December bean meal now. 168 the high, low at 163.50, settled 164.80, down $1.20. And the January bean meal, a 167 high, the low at $163.10, settled 163.70. They were off $1.20 as well. December bean oil, 2020 the high, the low at 19.95, settled 2018, up 10. And the January contract, 2044 the high, the low at 19.95, settled 2041, and they were up 34 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, it looks like it was a lower day today for livestock prices. January feeder cattle, the high $101.40, the low $100.20, the settlement $100.30, that down 80. March feeders, $97.90 the high, $96.60 the low, $96.72.5 the settlement, that down $1. April, $96.45 the high, $95.40 the low, finishing at $95.47.5, that down $107.5. December live cattle, 86.10 the high, 85.10 the low, 85.17.5 the settlement, that down 102.5. February, 87.35 the high, 86.30 the low, 86.52.5 the settlement, that down 92.5. December lean hog, 74.55 the high, 74.10 the low, 74.40 the settlement, that down 7.5 cents. February, 71.95 the high, 70.85 the low, finishing at 71.25, down 92.5. April, 70.20 the high, 69.35 the low, $70.05 the settlement, that down 47.5. And May lean hog, 70.55 the high, 69.70 the low, 70.45 the settlement, that down 50. And February bellies, today's high 98.10, the low 96.80, the settlement 97.50, that down 60. And now let's take a look at what's happening on Wall Street as far as the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 are looking. The Dow is currently up 33 points at 10,672. The NASDAQ up 11 at 2,159. The S&P 500 4 higher at 1203.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Granert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming families for the St. Petersburg State Ballet Theater's presentation of Romeo and Juliet, the National Acrobats of Taiwan, and Japan's Kodo Drummers. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit KrannertCenter.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science, so let's ask Dr.